Although we do this, we tend to do this generally anyway. So the in-group is, let's take the example of Jehovah's Witnesses. So we, the Jehovah's Witnesses, are the in-group. Everyone outside of us is the out-group. They don't belong to us. They won't understand us. Don't mix with them. Don't stay with them unless you're trying to convert them.
Sure.
So we have the physical and psychological isolation. We have the dress code. We have the stripping of the individual identity. We have the reinforcement of the programming, the values, et cetera. Then we have the sense of belonging, the sense of acceptance and significance, because you gain a sense of significance now that you belong to this group, because now your individual identity has been stripped. You are now a Jehovah's Witness, or you're so-and-so in the military, or you're this fan in this club. So all of it goes to the core of stripping you away from thinking for yourself to accepting whatever is told to you, falling in line, as they say in the military,
sure,
thinking the way that everyone else thinks, acting the way that everyone else acts, doing what everyone else is doing, even using the same language that everyone's using. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, what does that lead to? The idea of the cult is to control.
Yeah.
And when we can control, what we say, well, what's the benefit? The benefit for a cult is either that cult leader is controlling and getting what he wants, whether it's money, often it's sex, because the group that you just talked about is all about sex.
Yeah.
It was not even about money. It was about sex. The leader would have sex with lots of the women. But that's very common when you tend to have the male gurus. Most of the gurus or the cult leaders tend to be male, and they tend to be looking for the women. And you have these women
who are attracted to a leader like that, someone who's charismatic and...
Yeah, in fact, you said the next point. The first point I was going to say was you have women that also recruit younger girls for the cult, for the cult leader.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, well, how did that first woman get in and how did she get the other girls in? And that's to your point that, in fact, I said this about Bikram, the guy with the yoga guide. And do you know his story?
No.
So, and I can't remember, Chowdhury Bikram. So he started this big yoga movement that became huge in America. And then he starts getting accused of sexual abuse, sexual molestation, et cetera. The government comes down on him. And he was doing the same thing. He made himself to be like a cult leader. So, and this is before I even read about this, I had a friend of mine that told me this story, whereby he would be sitting on the stage giving his lectures or talking to the girls about yoga, because 80% of the people there are girls.
Sure.
And he'd have women that were brushing his hair while he's talking. So what are you saying? You're saying this is the godlike person. Mm-hmm. We are here to worship him. So then you add another level of submission, that you're submitting to the cult leader, or whether you're submitting to the religion, whether it's a statue and you got to kiss the feet of the statue, but it is submission also enters this. So the cult leader then has control. The people are submitting to him. He's getting either money, sex, or some other form of influence. And ultimately his goal is to get obedience out of you. So I've used the word control. It's a little higher than that. It's seeking total obedience from you so that he can get what he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting when on this series, this Keith Raniere, Keith Raniere, that's the guy, but it's interesting how it plays out, just like you said, because what would happen is people who are first introduced to this group or this cult, they come in and like you said, a lot of the women just like praise this guy. Oh, you got to meet Keith. But it's oftentimes like at the very beginning, no one can meet him. He's like off limits, right? That's kind of one of the tactics they use to make him unavailable. Like, they tout him. They talk about, they praise him and praise him. Oh, he's amazing. He's amazing. But you can't meet him yet. You know, he's just, you know, but you'll get a chance to, and it builds the anticipation. Yeah.
Right. It's called edification.
Yeah.
There's an actual term for it because it's a strategy.
Yep.
It's an edification comes from the Spanish word edificio, which means building. Mm-hmm. So it actually comes from the verb to build. The idea is I'm going to build up Jonathan and Sean. I'm going to edify them to this person so that I can close, so that Jonathan and Sean can close the deal.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, look, you got to meet Sean and Jonathan. I don't know if they're going to have time because these guys are just so busy. Yeah. And seriously, you will not believe how amazing these two guys are. Right. These guys have extraordinary wisdom, extraordinary insights, but it's really hard to get to them because they're so busy and they're so important. They're so in demand. They've got such an extraordinary reputation. I don't know if I can get you in front of them, but I promise I will. But you'll just be so lucky and so blessed if I can get you in front of them.
Yeah, so you come in predisposed to see things that you may not have seen without the edification.
The edification serves to create an image about the person I'm edifying and to put them on a pedestal and to make them out to be higher and more significant than you and I who are having this conversation. We talk about with Keith Rainier or whoever it is, and we keep saying how great that person is. And incidentally, I've experienced this too because I was part of an MLM years ago.
Sure.
So the beauty of what I do isn't just that I have a doctorate in health psychology, human behavior, and hypnosis. I've also experienced this stuff. I grew up in a religion. I went through MLM, and it was at MLM where they taught us the term edification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they would say, look, before you bring in your recruit, make sure you edify your group leader, whoever it is, and then take them to that person, and that person will close the deal because we were trying to get $5,000 out of each person. That's how they would do it. And then for the top guy, this blew my mind. So I went, you know, we'd watch him on video and everyone would just be talking about him like he was a god before he came on video. And I'm thinking, I think the guy's name was, I don't remember the guy's name, was Gold or but I ended up going to Vegas to see this guy. And we were in some big venue where there was, you know, 10,000, 15,000 people. And I was already told when he comes on the stage, you have to stand. I'm like, stand? Is this the national anthem? What am I standing for? And he comes on the stage and they're standing and all they're doing is applauding him for 2 or 3 minutes. As he's talking, you're not allowed to sit. You have to keep standing. What is it saying? That I'm in the presence of someone so special that I can't just sit back and relax. I can't slouch. I have to say, I'm fully present here for you. I recognize that you are so special.
Sure.
So these are the kind of things that go on. And unless you can break it apart like we're doing step by step, you wouldn't see it happening. You wouldn't even know it's happening.
So here's my question. Let's shift gears a little bit, Patrick. Mm-hmm. I could see these things what we're talking about, with the exception of maybe the isolation, but even then I could make a case for that. In just about every corporation, like if I work at Exxon, or if I work at GE, back when Jack was in charge of GE, I mean, he was a very...
Jack Welch?
Yeah. You know, he had a very strong culture and leadership, and, you know, you're expected to work long hours and you move up the ranks.
Can I do a timeout?
Yeah.
What word did you just use?
I used a lot. I'm not...
You said the word culture.
Yeah, culture.
Yep.
What is culture?
Well, the root word is cult, so...
There you go.
So what's the difference between an actual cult and then something like your average sports team where there's a group of fans? And like, how do we draw the distinction between those two? How do we know when something goes too far?
Well, the problem is if it goes too far, you're probably already in it. You may not even be aware it's gone too far. We're going to distinguish between a cult and a destructive cult.
Okay.
And we might actually create three distinctions. A destructive cult, a cult, and a group. You could say, this is my group. This is my group of sports fans. I am a fan of the Los Angeles Lakers or whoever.
Right.
So I'm a fan of them. And these fans are part of my group. So I identify with them. And I'm dropping my individual identity for a while. But there are boundaries. And I know where I begin and where I end, and I know what my limitations are with that until such time that they're asking me for something I'm not willing to give.
Right.
Then we have a cult that's starting to put particular demands on me, and it's starting to do the, whether it's, even if it's not physical isolation, it's, or psychological isolation, it's you must devote yourself to these core values of the corporation.
Okay.
And if you're okay because you say, you know what, GE and Jack Welch have core values that I admire and to which I choose to adhere, that's okay. The cult becomes destructive when it takes over your life and you're now cutting yourself off from your friends and family or anyone else who disagrees with you. You're not allowed to talk to anyone else about what you're doing because you want it to be secret. And in some other way, it's destroying your life, whether it's taking your money, it's taking away your psychological power, or it's getting you to believe in them and stop believing in traditional medicine. I don't know if I fully answered your question. I'd like to give one more example. There was a woman in the 90s, Huldah Clark, who claimed that she could cure cancer, all cancers and even AIDS. The woman died of cancer. But more to something greater and more significant and more shocking than that is the impact she had on people. And there's a specific case of a woman, I don't recall the woman's name, who went to, who had some sort of cancer, underwent the treatment of this woman, Huldah Clark. And as the woman was saying, look, I'm getting more pains, I'm getting this pain, Huldah Clark was saying, no, 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 you're fine, continue, continue. Hmm. But the woman's cancer was actually growing and she died of it. So now you're talking about something completely destructive where this woman became became a guru at the very least and almost like a cult leader because she was saying, this is the only way you got to do it. You just got to do it this way. Don't talk to anyone else. Don't expose yourself to anyone else. So I think you've raised a really good point, guys, when you're talking about corporate culture, because sometimes it is a cult.
Yeah.
Depending on what's expected of you and what you're expected to do, and maybe you're expected to lie or to cheat or to give up your own values for the company's values.
Right.
Or for the company's desire and objectives for profit. How many people were in different companies and they knew that the company was lying, was cheating, was stealing, and they continued on it until it all collapsed? You know, the famous, the house of cards has collapsed. Yeah. And there's been a lot of companies like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think back to Enron and
sure. Yes.
And that was a big, big example that there.
That wasn't one person, right? I mean, it had to have been a whole handful of people or more who knew what was going on, but continued. That's when they've given away their power to something else, or they've been overpowered and overtaken by the greed.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about like what a cult is, kind of this, maybe this blurry line of how there's a lot of organizations or groups that are using these ideas in a dangerous, destructive way. Is there a place, you know, we're all about persuasion and marketing and sales here, and we've talked about, you know, using some of these things to get people to buy services or you know, goods that are good for them. And we've talked about how you can use some of these qualities. How do you do that without slipping into being destructive? Like, how can you use these things for good and not for destruction? Or do you think that's just not possible? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
It is possible. The simple question is, what's your ultimate goal, motivation, and intention? If I'm selling a product that I believe in and that I believe will help you, and now I'm using these tactics, these persuasive tactics to sell it to you, but I believe in the product and I know it's going to help you, then I might say the end justifies the means. But if I know I'm putting out some crap product, it's a crap ebook, or it's a product that I know doesn't do anything, like a lot of these supplements that have sold, if you actually do laboratory tests, you find out they usually don't contain 50% of what they say is supposed to be in them. But if you're selling that product, that supplement or ebook, and you know it has no value, you know it's not going to make any difference to anyone, then you are being, it's beyond lacking integrity, then you're corrupt. You're corrupting yourself.
So let's go back to the start with James Ray. Mm-hmm. Do you think he started out with good intentions and you just the power gets to you and the praise and the ego kicks in? I mean, what do you think happens with him? Or do you think he started out just, this is an easy group, or this is an easy way to go after people? Like, having studied him, what's your theory?
I think that's a brilliant question because you can apply that to lots of people because you talked there about power. So the first thing we need to remember is the words of Lord Acton. I can't remember his first name was James, but it was Lord Acton who said, all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts easily. All power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that was in 1880. And here's the interesting part about that. What he's basically saying is people in a position of power get corrupted by the power. And the more power you give them, the more corrupted they'll become.
Sure.
Now, here's the question. Why did he say that? To whom was he saying that? And what was he talking about? He was talking about the Catholic Church. He was saying that there were too many people who were getting too much power in the church and they were becoming corrupted. So it's interesting. First, we have to say, look at people in positions of power. They tend to get corrupted. I've written a lot about the corruption by power in people. You can take the example of Schwarzenegger. You got to ask yourself, why the hell would Schwarzenegger sleep with that woman when he's married to Maria Shriver, who's a beautiful, intelligent woman? Was it because it was just an opportunity because she was just there? Was it because he had power? And there are many better examples of people in positions of power who tend to cheat, lie, steal, betray their wife, betray their values because they get corrupted by the power. So that's, I think we need to start there. And then say, okay, let's take this specific example of James Arthur Ray. What was his original intention? Well, you know, the guy became first as some sort of salesman, then he became an author. He became some sort of self-help teacher, guru, actually. He wrote a book on harmonic wealth. But again, I think what happened was along the way, he got more and more power. Yeah. So he started to believe, not just in the stuff that he was teaching, but he believed he was what he was teaching. There's a difference between, and I say this to people, listen, I have a great message, but be careful about putting me on a pedestal or making me to be a guru. Be careful about making me to be like I'm perfect because I'm not. Look at the message and ask yourself, is there merit in the message? But when I start to think that I'm a god because of my message, it's easy to become corrupted. And I think he just saw lots of opportunities there and he became corrupted.
I was watching a some recent documentary on Charles Manson that said, you know, just talking about that, the beginnings. And I think in prison, I forgot, I think he was in prison maybe for drugs or something, but while in prison, he got a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People and read through that. And probably, I don't know if he started out, it didn't say, I don't know if his whole purpose in starting to read that book was the intention of influencing people for evil, but it certainly helped him and benefited him in the long run to do that, to do exactly just that. So maybe, you know, that, you know, power gets to you when you're able to persuade and influence people.
Well, and you've also got to look again at who was he targeting and who were the people that came to him.
Absolutely.
They all tended to be middle class, middle to upper class.
Sure.
And they were lost and they were confused. And it was the same drawing in. I can help you. And he gave them a meaning. He gave them a purpose. And it's very easy to start shifting someone so that they lose their own identity. They lose their own morals and values.
Yeah.
And they pledge allegiance to the leader. Go back to the Nazis. And when Hitler did that salute, he wanted the people to salute him back because they were with the hand up. What are you doing? I pledge my allegiance to you. Mm-hmm. And that's the more that someone realizes I've got power over these people, unless that person can keep himself in check or herself, or unless that person has someone around them to keep them in check, he will become corrupted by power. That's the majority of people. The majority of people who get in those positions of power become corrupted. And, you know, I know it's a bit of a cliche that you watch these Hollywood movies and the person says, like in Training Day, when Denzel Washington's character says, I started out just like you. I wanted to change the world. I wanted to do this. And then along the way, he says, I realized I wasn't making a difference or whatever, so I thought I would take something for me. And then he becomes completely corrupted.
Great movie. Yeah.
So
I love that movie.
Yeah. There's so many great lessons in that movie.
Yeah.
But I keep thinking about that question you ask, and I don't like to say that the person's intention was never good. I prefer to think the person had a good intention and they became corrupted along the way.
Sure.
Now, there are some people who right from the beginning set out and say, this is what I'm going to do. And they have the clear and corrupt intention in mind. Right. I don't think that was James Arthur Ray, but I do think a lot of them, a lot of those teachers from The Secret got caught up in this concept and fooled themselves as well.
Yeah.
You know, I, as a human behavior expert, as a person that coaches people, I want to empower you and teach you that you create your own outcomes. I want to empower and teach you that you can go from a fixed mindset, which is whatever I am, whatever skills I have, that's it. I can't develop my skills. I can't become smarter. I can't develop my talents. I can't be more creative. I can't change my character or personality. That's a fixed mindset. I do want to move you to the growth mindset, which says, this is the deck of hands I've been dealt, but I can do more with it. I can develop my intelligence. I can develop my skills, my creativity, my character, my personality. So I want to teach you that, and I want to do what Jocko Willink does, which is teach extreme ownership.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always a limit. Now, what I mean by that is everyone, you know, it's like all these Oprah fans who love to hear, oh, you're really just afraid of your own power. No, I'm not afraid of my own power. I recognize that there are limits. No matter how many of us come together, we can't stop a tsunami. We can't stop a hurricane. We can't stop an earthquake. There are certain things that are beyond our control. No matter how much I visualize whatever my life will be, I can't stop someone from being drunk and driving and hitting my car. There are things that are outside of our control. So what I teach guys is I say, get clear about what you can control and what you can't control. Control your thoughts, control your emotions, control your beliefs, let go of the rest. You can't change everything. I don't know, does that make sense? Are you understanding my point? Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious. I've got a thought that's going in my head. I wanted to see if you mm-hmm. have an answer for it. And if you don't, that's fine. We've talked about this idea of power corrupting. I was in your research and your, you know, study of, you know, human psychology and all that. What is it about power that tends to corrupt? I mean, what it's, you know, we can say that, but like, is there any studies like what's going on, why it happens? Like what trigger is being pulled? What bias is being, you know, triggered in our brain that all of a sudden, you know, a certain amount of power and boom, we're kind of pushed over the edge.
I'll give you my opinion.
Yeah,
and I have done a little bit of research into this. I wouldn't want to say that this is the conclusive definitive answer, but I would say that power is a primal urge in the sense of when we have power, we feel safer. The more power we have, like think of yourself as a child, you're automatically attracted to your father because of his physical presence.
Right.
Because for a child, both adults, mum and dad, are like seven-story buildings. But dad has a deep voice. Dad has a physical, stronger body than a woman, generally speaking. And he's going, because of the testosterone, he engages in a more assertive, competitive, aggressive way. And when we know that we're in his fold, under his wing, inside his umbrella, we feel safer. So the first thing is we're attracted to people who have power, who exude power because we feel safe. And I think that there's a tendency for us when we see the opportunity to have power over other people that we lose our own morality and I think we become more animalistic. I'd love to do more research into that and come back to you on that. I don't know that there's any one thing other than, you know, there is a shift in our brain where we realize we have a lot of power and there's going to be chemical changes. There's going to be endorphins that are released because when we recognize we have power, we get a rush, not just the adrenaline rush, but we get these dopamine and other endorphins that make us feel good. We go like, oh, this power feels good.
Yeah.
So there's also that component. And that's why I say unless there's some way for you to keep yourself in check, it's easy for the power to overpower you.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say, just an observation that I've had in watching Friends and reading stories and things like that, and hearing interviewing people and things like that. You talked in the beginning about what makes people vulnerable and susceptible to this kind of stuff. And one thing I've seen that's been very interesting to me is actually like really quick or kind of big success. Like I've had friends that have had big like buyouts for their companies, right? And all of a sudden they've got everything they have ever needed. And now there's this void, but it's the same thing. It's a void, right? That's now there's this void of what do I do? Because I kind of pinned my whole life on getting to this point, and I got here like 50 years sooner than I thought I was going to. And it creates this gap, this vacuum that has to be filled.
Great point. So I would say that there's two elements to this, or two levels. The first is I've written a whole series of articles on the top 20 psychological issues of celebrities. Hmm. And the number one issue is the same issue that is for every one of us, which is, you know, what actually happened to you as a child? How did it affect you? And the number two issue is what we refer to as the imposter syndrome. The imposter syndrome really boils down to, if they could see who I am, they'd see I'm really not that good. I'm not that talented, which is I'm not good enough. I don't belong. I'm not worthy. I'm not special. I'm not valuable. There's something wrong with me. I'm an outsider. So if you have this instant success, and perhaps you don't even feel like you've really worked for it, or you've worked for it and you've got instant success, because it's so big and it's so emotionally overwhelming, we start to question, am I an imposter? Is this true? Is this real? Do I deserve this? Am I worthy of this? Yeah. Is it a fluke? That's exactly what Charlie Sheen said when he was filming the first Wall Street movie. He would go out and get drunk all night, and then he'd come back and he'd show up on set at 6:30 in the morning, and he'd say, I was always afraid that they'd find me out, that they might find out that I'm an imposter. And he used the words, is this all just a fluke? So that's the first thing that happens to celebrities who become really, really big, and now they've got all this power, all this influence, people throwing themselves at them, and they question, am I worthy? Am I good enough? That's number one. Number two, you said something really interesting. So they've had your friends or whoever these people are, they've had great success. There's a big buyout. Now they say, now what? What do I do? There's an emptiness. That's because they've now got to find a new purpose, a right. new meaning for life. If their only meaning was to build a company to sell it, unless they're going to do that again, they're going to feel completely lost. So you've got to have some sort of meaning. And I don't necessarily mean a legacy, because you are the legacy, whatever you're creating now. But in what way can you contribute to other people?
Yeah.
In what way can you help other people? In what way can you make someone feel better? In what way can you add some significance to someone else's life? You guys are doing that with your show. You know, you're talking about the drinks you have and people thinking, oh, I'm going to go try that drink. Or you're bringing on various guests to share some insights, some information. You're making a difference in this way through your medium, through your channel, through your vehicle. And maybe the day will come and you say, guys, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do something different. Maybe someone buys you out and they say, you know, we want your audience. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to say, well, what am I going to do next? Mm-hmm. And I believe there always has to be a next. UCLA, was it UCLA? UCLA in conjunction with, I think, UNC, University of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Two of those colleges got together and they did studies and they found out that there is greater health and greater longevity, taking into account every other factor, if your goals have purpose. Mm. Not just if you have goals, but the more purposeful your goals are, the healthier you'll be and the longer you'll live. And you're going to ask yourself, that's absolutely bizarre. And then they also found out the same thing with behavior. If you engage in activities that are purely hedonistic versus activities that have greater meaning and greater purpose for you, your immune system also responds accordingly. I would think, well, surely if I'm engaging in pleasurable activities, my inflammation should be down and my immune system should be up. but it's the actual opposite. When I'm engaging in meaningful activities, activities that connect me to other people like we're doing, or activities that are helping other people, my immune system goes up and my inflammation lowers. And they did this with actual tests. It wasn't just, oh, we think this. And they were looking at the human genome. So again, to come back to your very basic question that has such great power to it, whatever happens in your life, keep looking for new meaning and new purpose, constantly reinventing yourself. If this is over and maybe it doesn't call out to you anymore, find something new.
Yeah, I think if I look back on whether it's a business I've been involved in, mine or somebody else's, or just how I feel on a day-to-day basis, when I'm feeling down or it's really tough and hard and struggle, it's usually because I'm inward focused. And then when I'm focused on other people, like listening to you or helping, you know, sharing a message with somebody else, everything feels lighter, easier, you know, it's more fun, all that kind of stuff. So, and I think that's what happens, you know, listening to you, also talk about the power. It's me focused if I get it wrapped up in the power, as opposed to being a service where I'm going out to whoever's in the group, right? Even if I'm the group leader, I can keep it more pure by focusing on them and their results and what they get out of it instead of it being about me. Seems that way for me anyway. Yeah.
Well, what a great insight and what a great thing to share, to be able to say, you know, I can distinguish when I'm focused inward versus when I'm focused on other people. I mean, that's a beautiful thing to say, because it's not something that many people
will often say. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes sure. It might take a week of self-pity, but usually I can turn around. It used to take a lot longer, but I'm getting better at it for sure.
But I know from guys, Jonathan and Sean, from the show, from the workshops that I do, I can tell you the most meaningful work I do is when I'm focused on other people. It's just incredible. And I call it being in the zone. You know how we all talk about this being in the zone?
Yeah.
To me, being in the zone is you forget about yourself and you're fully present with all of your senses. So that can be just jogging. It doesn't necessarily mean I'm jogging to raise money for a charity. But when you let go of this thought of yourself and you're fully engaged in the moment, you're in the zone. When you put yourself in a zone where you're helping people and you can see them responding, you can see them gaining benefit, the benefit that I get is extraordinary out of it. I mean, it's just unbelievable. When I do workshops, I've done workshops for Shell, for Orange Theory, for Air France, and my greatest satisfaction comes from working with people and seeing them make their own breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they become open, they open their heart, they're being vulnerable. And I'm talking about corporations. And what I get out of that is just so much more meaningful than anything I could do, whether it's, you know, being on a paddleboard, driving my little classic Corvette convertible with the top down through the Florida Keys, or whatever I'm going to do that's pleasurable. There's nothing that compares to that when I'm actually in service to other people. And I would have never thought that that would be the case until, you know, I did it. And then I realized this is more fulfilling. It fills me fully when I'm doing that more than anything else.
Sure. And I think that's the gold standard with, if you're doing sales and marketing and selling, you know, products and services, as long as you keep that focus, Jonathan, you with your customers and manufacturing, like as long as you're focused on their best result and not just getting the commission check. Like,
yeah,
I think that's the keeps you from going down that slippery slope. So
yeah.
Can I ask you guys a question? Cause you said you're both in the military, or you were in the military. Didn't you feel like that? I mean, wasn't the intention to help, to save, to protect?
Sure.
Yeah. Most days, some days it wasn't, some days depend on who your up higher ups or most close higher ups were.
In what sense?
It was also, you didn't want to fail. And I think that's, you didn't want to have the stigma. And I think that plays a part in a lot of, just like we're talking about, you know, people that are followers, you don't want to have the stigma of falling short or failing at something. So you have this, I think we talk about a lot of times in the psychology of influence, Cialdini, which is the commitment and consistency, where you commit to something and you don't want to fail. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people that are, they get they get into something or they focus on something, and they don't want to be seen as a failure once they make a commitment. And I think that's a lot in the military. You're like, you're committed. You're a part of something, but you also in the back of your mind, you don't want to quit, you know, and right. they've indoctrinated you. I mean, you know, in a good way, you shouldn't want to quit, but you know, you're thinking there's no way I'm going home, you know? Yeah. And, as a side note, you know, I think about, it brings to mind this, this Nexium cult, which, I mean, it's amazing. I think it's fascinating, the psychology of how people, you know, they commit in different ways. And this one, they would take a brand, you know, literally a brand. Can you imagine like taking a brand, a physical brand to yourself and burning
into
yourself? I remember that. But that creates, I'm sure that creates like a certain level of commitment there that it's very hard to get away from, you know.
I mean, people do that with tattoos all the time.
Tattoos, too, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That also, yes. And that goes to ownership and to a sense of belonging. Like, I belong to this group permanently now. I am, this is official. I'm part of this group. I belong to this group. And again, it strips you of the individual identity because you're now branded.
Absolutely.
And also the other element in cults is the stripping away of boundaries. Mm-hmm. So now my boundaries are gone, so I'll allow myself to be branded. And I will, as I mentioned earlier, submit and subjugate myself to the leader or to the cult and to its ideals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, man, I think we could probably talk about this for a while, but we're about out of time. So, Patrick, where can people learn more about you and what you do? We didn't really get too deep into how you help people, but where can people find out more about you?
My website is patrickwanis.com, W-A-N-I-S. If you are actually looking for individual help to set yourself free from the past, I have a process that I developed over many years called Subconscious Rapid Transformation Technique. It's very powerful, particularly for people who've experienced trauma. And it works and it's effective over the phone without you reliving the trauma or reliving the pain.
Nice.
So that's something worth exploring if that's something you need to do.
Very cool. Yeah, I think a lot of people could benefit from that for sure. So, all right. Well, Jonathan, I'll let you take us out.
Patrick, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming on. It probably didn't get into everything, but time flies when you're talking about stuff like this.
Let me just say in closing, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yeah.
You guys asked some great questions. You really did ask some great questions because you came from different perspectives. And so you made me think in some other angles that I hadn't thought. Mm-hmm. You're also very gracious in allowing me to speak and to keep speaking and to keep speaking. I do notice that. And thank you for allowing me to share a message. So thank you.
Absolutely. Patrick, it's been a pleasure. I hope you have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Jonathan. Bye.
Sean is fascinating, man. The way the mind works and the way hypnosis and people kind of fall in line. I, you know, when you mentioned the military or when we brought up the military, it's like one of those things you don't think about until, man, so much of that is like programmed in.
Yeah, he starts rattling off the what the cult looks like, and I'm like, check, check, check.
Like, wait a minute. No individuality. Yeah, check.
Uniforms.
Isolation. Yeah. Check, check, check. Yeah, exactly. Fall, you know, even to marching right in step.
Literally.
Exactly.
Yeah, literally. So, yeah.
Man, that's something to think about. But we hope everyone has enjoyed the show, and you can find us as always over at persuasionbythepint.com. You can find us on all of your podcast platforms, any of your favorite podcast apps. We'll see you next time.
See ya.